From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The real cause of the blackout was a circuit called greed, the predictable result of a con game called deregulation.
In the aftermath of the biggest blackout in U.S. history, we'll begin to examine its causes. We'll go to Ohio, to First Energy, which owns the plant investigators believe is where the blackout began. Cleveland Congressmember and now presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich has been taking them on for years. We'll also speak with investigative reporter Greg Palast and Ohio anti-nuclear activist Harvey Wasserman, who wrote The Last Energy War, The Battle Over Utility Deregulation. We'll speak with a major advocate of deregulation, head of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, as well as a whistleblower at a utility there for more than 30 years. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Power has been restored to tens of millions in the Northeast after the nation suffered its worst blackout in history on Thursday and Friday. New York City, Cleveland, Detroit, Toronto, and Ottawa were among the cities to lose power. Many energy experts now believe the blackout began in Ohio, where a series of line failures and plant shutdowns spread rapidly across the region. Much of the blame has been placed on the nation's antiquated energy grid. Former Energy Secretary Bill Richardson said the country is running on a, quote, third world grid. A proposal to strengthen the nation's power transmission center has been stalled by Senate Republicans for months. On Thursday, President Bush said the blackout should serve as a, quote, wake-up call. But the Washington Post reports President Bush plans to side with opponents of the plan and delay an upgrade of the system by 3 years. Among the groups investigating what happened is the North American Electric Reliability Council, which was formed after the 1965 blackout to monitor energy utilities. The Wall Street Journal reports the council had been warning Congress for 4 years that deregulation of the energy industry has made its job harder to monitor and enforce rules. But Congress has so far refused to give the Energy Council enforcement powers. Investigators examining the cause of Thursday's blackout are centering specifically on the Ohio company First Energy, based in Akron. Though representatives from First Energy say it's too early to determine if its plant caused the problem. The energy firm has had a history of past problems since 1997, when it was formed from the merger of Ohio Edison, the Cleveland Electric Illuminating Company, and Toledo Edison. In 2001, it acquired General Public Utilities, which owned Pennsylvania Electric Company, Metropolitan Edison near Reading, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey Central Power and Light. Saboteurs blew up the main oil pipeline from Iraq to Turkey Saturday, halting oil exports to northern Iraq just 3 days after they began. And in Baghdad, over 300,000 homes have been left without water after the city's water main was bombed. Mortars were also fired at a large prison outside Baghdad, where the U.S. is holding 1,000 Iraqis prisoners. Six inmates died in the attack, 60 more were wounded. The Los Angeles Times reports the mortar attack was meant to hit the U.S. soldiers guarding the jail. After the mortar attack, U.S. troops shot and killed a journalist covering the story for the Reuters news agency. Soldiers claimed they mistook the cameraman's camera for a rocket-propelled grenade launcher, and they said they engaged him. The journalist, Mazen Dana, was 43 years old. He was considered by Reuters to be one of its finest cameramen. He was usually based in Hebron in the West Bank. He was a Palestinian. We'll have more on that story later in the program. The BBC is reporting a peace deal in Liberia is very close and that warring factions may sign an agreement to set up an interim government as early as today. The Los Angeles Times is reporting the Pentagon ignored an internal report that recommended sending 2,300 Marines into Liberia in July to quell the violence. The LA Times found the Pentagon rejected the report, forced it to be rewritten with toned-down language, and did not pass on the initial recommendation to President Bush. One official told the paper, quote, "The Pentagon squashed it. It was way too strong for their liking." The International Rescue Committee predicts thousands of Liberian lives would have been saved if the U.S. sent troops back in July. Former Ugandan dictator Idi Amin died Saturday at the age of 78 while living in exile in Saudi Arabia. He ruled Uganda from 1971 to 1979. During this time, up to 400,000 people were killed or disappeared out of a population of 12 million. He was never tried before an international court. A representative from Amnesty International said, quote, "Amin's death is a sad comment on the international community's inability to hold leaders accountable for gross human rights abuses. It was the international community's indifference that allowed Amin to escape justice," Amnesty said. One of the first major polls of voters in California finds Democratic Lieutenant Governor Cruz Bustamante to be leading the race to succeed Governor Gray Davis if voters recall Davis next month. Bustamante stood at 25%, 3 percentage points higher than Hollywood star Arnold Schwarzenegger. The other candidates trailed in the single digits. The California field poll also found Gray Davis to be the most unpopular governor in the 56 years since the poll was first conducted. Nearly 6% of Californians now back the recall. While the recall is set for October 7th, a federal judge in San Jose may delay the vote by months because the hasty schedule may violate the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Criticism against Schwarzenegger has been increasing by opponents to his left and right. Independent candidate and political columnist Arianna Huffington revealed last week that the Terminator actor had met with former Enron CEO Kenneth Lay in the midst of the California energy crisis. The Los Angeles Times reports Schwarzenegger's father had voluntarily joined the Nazi Party in Austria before World War II and served as a stormtrooper or brown shirt. The Washington Post reports that for 15 years, Schwarzenegger has served on the advisory board of U.S. English, Inc., which opposes bilingual education and advocates English to be the country's official language. On the Republican side, millionaire businessman and recall candidate Bill Simon has launched the race's first television commercial. He attacks both Governor Davis and Schwarzenegger for their tax policies. The multimillionaire Huffington also came under criticism after she released tax records that showed she paid less than $800 in federal taxes over the past 2 years. In Afghanistan, at least 22 people died in a gun battle after up to 400 Taliban fighters attacked government offices in the southeastern town of Barmal. The Israeli press is reporting that Israeli warplanes entered into Syria last week and buzzed the palace of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to warn Syria about its support for Hezbollah. Syrian sources dismiss the report. Meanwhile, Agence France-Presse reports a 16-year-old Israeli boy was killed in an attack near the Lebanese and Syrian border during an attack by Hezbollah. In campaign news, Governor Howard Dean of Vermont has named Stephen Grossman to a top campaign post. Grossman is the former head of AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, and ex-chair of the Democratic National Committee. The Wall Street Journal is reporting General Wesley Clark is leaning towards entering the Democratic race for president. Television ads urging Clark to run will soon air in 3 states. The ads are paid for by the group DraftWesleyClark.com. Calls for stricter child labor laws are increasing in the Washington state area after 3 16-year-old boys were killed last week in work-related accidents. One boy was crushed by a 12-foot crane. Two others were found dead in a cattle feed silo. They apparently died from hazardous fumes in the unvented silo. The Vatican, 40 years ago, instructed Catholic bishops around the world to cover up cases of sexual abuse or face excommunication from the church. This according to the Observer of London, which obtained 69 pages of internal church documents from Pope John the 23rd. An attorney representing victims abused by priests in the United States said the letter, quote, proves there was an international conspiracy by the church to hush up sexual abuse issues. It is a devious attempt to conceal criminal conduct and is a blueprint for deception and concealment. It's unknown how many people have been raped or sexually abused by Catholic priests. In Boston alone, the Massachusetts Attorney General estimates at least 800 children have been abused over the last 60 years. The White House is now backpedaling from supporting a plan that would have reduced the amount of pay to the nearly 160,000 U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. The plan, supported by Rumsfeld and the Pentagon to eliminate the $75 a month imminent danger pay and $150 family separation allowance, was first reported by the publication Army Times, which editorialized against the cutbacks. After coming under intense criticism by military families and Democratic presidential candidates, George Bush reversed his decision. A new Justice Department study has found that some 5.6 million people living in the United States have been incarcerated at one time or other. Over the last 30 years, the number of current and former prisoners has risen by 3.8 million. About 17%, or nearly 1 in 5 African-American male adults, have been or are in prison. That's compared to nearly 8% of Latino men and 12.5% of white men. The study went on to determine that if the incarceration rate from 2001 stays steady, 1 in 3 African-American men born in the year 2001 will serve time in jail at some point in their lives. Again, the figure is just a correction. 17%, or nearly 1 in 5 African-American male adults, have been or are in prison. That's compared to 8% of Latino men and 2.5% of white men. Beginning today, U.S. soldiers are planning to begin posting pictures of Saddam Hussein around to Crete in an effort to catch Saddam Hussein and his supporters. But these won't be any normal wanted pictures. Instead, the military has superimposed Saddam's head on the bodies of Hollywood stars like the late actress Veronica Lake, Zsa Zsa Gabor, Elvis Presley, and 80s rock star Billy Idol. Colonel Steve Russell told Reuters, quote, most of the locals will love him and they'll be laughing, but the bad guys are going to be upset, which will just make it easier for us to know who they are. An award-winning songwriter, Ed Townsend, has died at the age of 74. He's best known for the song Let's Get It On, which he penned for Marvin Gaye.
I love you. There's
And that's Let's Get It On, Marvin Gaye. Here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman, and a very special welcome back to the listeners of WBAI, knocked off the air during the largest blackout in U.S. history. And a very special thank you to the staff of Democracy Now! Who managed to make their way in on Friday morning by bike, by car, by foot. I'm not sure if someone took a boat in to broadcast Democracy Now! Around the country, despite the fact that we had to do it by candlelight and gas generator. Well, power has been restored to tens of millions of people in the Northeast after the nation suffered the worst blackout in Northeast history. New York City, Cleveland, Detroit, Toronto, Ottawa, among the cities to experience powerlessness. Many energy experts now believe the blackout began in Ohio, where a series of line failures and plant shutdowns spread rapidly across the country. Investigators examining the cause of Thursday's blackout are centering specifically on the company First Energy, based in Akron, Ohio. Representatives from First Energy say it's too early to determine if its own plant was the problem. The energy firm has had a history of past problems when it formed from a merger of Ohio Edison, Cleveland Electric Illuminating Company, and Toledo Edison. In 2001, it acquired General Public Utilities, which owned Pennsylvania Electric, Metropolitan Edison near Reading, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey Central Power and Light. We're going to start off today's program, where we look at the problems and the recommendations for solutions, with Cleveland Congressmember Dennis Kucinich, also Democratic presidential candidate, who has taken on First Energy for years. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Congressmember Kucinich.
Good morning.
Can you talk about the history of First Energy?
Well, my familiarity comes with one of its predecessor companies, the Cleveland Electric Illuminating Company, which in the 70s, according to records on file at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and in hearings before the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board, actually conducted a campaign, tireless campaign, to knock Cleveland's own municipally owned electric system out of business. And they did it through many devious ways of stopping Muni Light from being able to make repairs on its generator by interfering with the city council, by then the Muni Light couldn't buy power from other companies outside the state when they needed to do it, leaving CEI as being the only customer that Muni could turn to, where they then, in some cases, tripled the cost of power in order to run up the municipal system's debt. And the resistance of this campaign was when Muni Light needed a transfer of power. CEI's engineers operated in such a way as to deliberately cause an outage on the Muni system. I mean, this is a company that has operated a nuclear reactor knowing that it was defective. The reactor has a hole in its head. This is the one at Port Clinton, Ohio. They have ignored safety precepts. They've basically been had the regulators wink at them. And it's just kind of symptomatic to see them being involved in a massive blackout in affecting 50 million people.
Now, they're saying, of course, it's too early to tell that this is where it took place, that there was a lot of emphasis on lights out throughout the Northeast, particularly New York. Cleveland suffered, in many cases, the worst situation because it was not only about electricity, it was about water as well because of the pumping system, the electric pumping system that you have.
Well, Cleveland did suffer greatly once this outage occurred, because the water pumps are run electrically, and the every power expert who's looked at this massive blackout has determined that it occurred because of instabilities in the electric power in the First Energy service district. And First Energy has consistently failed to invest in upgrade of equipment. Their emphasis has been on holding on to their cash so that they maintain the fiscal stability of their company while Wall Street's looking at it. I can understand that on one hand. On the other hand, they have laid off personnel that have been involved in maintenance. They've not adequately repaired their transmission lines to the point of where they could
hold up under any kind of changes in power. And so we have a condition right now where a company that has already been under close scrutiny for mismanagement of a nuclear power plant, which is, you know, located on Lake Erie, deficiencies in a power plant that came close to creating a breach in the reactor vessel, and which came close to contaminating our lake, great water supply of fresh water for, you know, the whole Great Lakes region. This company is now, you know, once again under scrutiny, and frankly, it ought to be. And it's in a larger sense, Amy, this is symptomatic of what happens with deregulation.
We're talking to Congressmember Dennis Kucinich, who is now in Iowa, campaigning early for the Iowa primary, who really made your name as both the mayor of Cleveland and recently as taking on utilities. This is one of your priority issues.
Right. Well, you know, the right of utility franchise is vested in the public. You know, people don't always know that. They don't know that the utilities get their permission to operate by having a system set up at a state level, which gives them a permit to operate, franchise, in exchange for service and for a fair rate. Well, what's happened is, as utility monopolies have grown, they've been overcharging people for power, and they haven't always had the best service. And we have a condition now where utility monopolies are gaining great power, no pun intended, politically, and are able to set the rules so that they can keep growing, and in effect, public ability to be able to set the rules. I mean, the growth of Enron was a prime example, where Enron received help from the administration and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in being able to control wholesale markets and drive up the cost of electricity. I mean, what people pay for electricity is no small matter. And the government has a lot to do with whether the price is going to be fair or not. And, you know, with this whole deregulation that happened 10 years ago, we were told that this was going to decrease U.S. energy dependence through increased domestic production and conservation. Well, that hasn't, you know, we haven't seen the conservation. We were told that if they restructure the electric utility industry, it's going to spur competition. Exactly the opposite happened. And we were told, and you know, that as they work to ease licensing for nuclear power plants, this is going to work to the American public's benefit. Well, actually, the easing of licensing for nuclear power plants at this point represents a threat to this country, because the nuclear power plants that have been relicensed, and it's more relicensing than new licensing, have not necessarily been up to safety standards. So we have this whole energy system that needs to be transformed, and it needs to be transformed towards towards renewable energy and sustainable energy, and away from nuclear and away from all these non-renewables that where these energy companies right now are just trying to drain these systems, run them into the ground, not make improvements, and as a result, you get the kind of exposure to blackouts which occurred in last week.
As you take on the president of this country in your race for president, one of the things that Newsday points out in its coverage of the blackout is that the deregulation of the nation's energy industry in the 90s added many more uncertainties for both traditional utilities and their customers. In the frenzied deregulation atmosphere of the past 5 years, private investors supported companies building highly efficient gas-fired power plants, while traditional investments in the transmission line and regulated equipment took a back seat. Also says, although Bush's original energy plan called for $6 billion in conservation-related tax breaks, critics say he's favored the needs of big business over conservation efforts. For instance, they say Bush officials in 2001 pushed to roll back energy efficiency standards for air conditioners mandated by the year 2006, which would have reduced power demand by 14,000 megawatts, the equivalent of 50 medium-sized power plants. The administration called the restrictions anti-competitive.
Well, you know, here's a great example. When it comes time to conserve, the only thing they're interested in conserving are the profits of the utility industries. And then they'll turn around and create a war in the Middle East for the purposes of serving oil interests. I mean, this is an administration which is typical of any administration, would just serve corporate interests, and it doesn't matter about the future of America. It doesn't matter about the future of our planet. We need right now to take steps and directions of creating a sustainable energy portfolio of I'd say, at least 20% by the year 2010. We need to move towards not only conservation, but we need to make sure that we incentivize the production of wind, solar, hydrogen and geothermal, biomass, all of these types of energies that take us away from non-sustainable sources. And excuse me, one of the things that I've learned, there are 23 Indian reservations where if we just harness the wind power that sweeps across the plains, we could provide 330,000 megawatts of power that would be half of the U.S. demand, and that would be with wind power.
Finally, Congressmember Kucinich, in a minute after the break, we're going to go to a debate on the issue of deregulation. But I just wanted to ask you, as you're on the presidential campaign trail, you're in Iowa. Right now, as you for so long have represented the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, how it feels to be taking on Howard Dean, who is now seen as the major opposition candidate within the Democratic Party?
Well, if you're going to talk the talk, you've got to walk the walk. And with all due respect to Dr. Dean, a doctor who turns his back on universal health care with 8,000 physicians out there favoring it, could hardly be considered progressive. And someone who has taken a position not to reform NAFTA and or GATT through canceling it and reinstituting bilateral trade based on workers' rights, human rights, and the environment, there's a question about being progressive. And there's a question about being progressive when you come into a campaign and you support public financing and you turn around and start to equivocate on it because you're worried about keeping pace with the president's fundraising, and that means you can only get your money from heavy corporate contributors. I think as this campaign develops, it'll be very clear that I'm offering a real progressive alternative for the American people. And again, if you're going to talk the talk, walk the walk, we'll see where our respective campaigns continue to walk and run as we move through these next few months of the campaign, and I'm quite confident that as that happens, I'm going to be gaining increased support, and this campaign will be there to provide a real alternative to the American people, not a series of head fakes in the direction of progressivism for the crowds, and then after the campaign events are over, you go back to this kind of approach to centrism, which only blurs the differences between the parties, causes people to become disillusioned, and results in people not turning out on Election Day.
Well, Congressmember Dennis Kucinich, thank you for being with us. Congressmember Kucinich is from Cleveland, which experienced some of the worst effects of the blackout over the last days. Thanks for being with us. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, a roundtable discussion about deregulation. We'll be speaking with the head of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, who is all for deregulation, Greg Pallas, who's written a piece that has been one of the most read pieces on the Internet over the last few days, people who had the battery power in their computers to read it during the blackout. We'll also be joined by a man who's worked in utilities for more than three decades who left because of the direction they were going in. We'll also be speaking with a leading alternative energy expert. You're listening to Democracy Now! in this aftermath of the biggest blackout in U.S. history. Stay with us.
Well, I'm beginning to see the light.
Beginning to see the light. Velvet Underground here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our discussion in the aftermath of the biggest blackout in U.S. history. We are joined on the telephone now from Detroit by Fred Smith. He is the CEO of CEI. That's the Competitive Enterprise Institute. We're joined on the phone from Long Island, New York by Greg Palast, investigative reporter with the BBC, author of the book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. His piece, Power Outage, Traced to Dim Bulb in White House, has been circulating, swirling around the internet in the aftermath of the blackout. We're also joined on the phone by Jack Casaza, who worked for the utilities for more than three decades, a power engineer working with Public Service Electric and Gas Company, PSE&G, and left dissatisfied with the direction the utilities were going. He's written the book Sham Shame Inside the Electric Power Industry. And Harvey Wasserman is with us. He is a longtime energy activist, has written for Seven Stories Press, The Last Energy War, The Battle Over Utility Deregulation. But we'll begin with Fred Smith, who's just landed in Detroit now that the planes are back on their feet or have got their wings. Welcome to Democracy Now!
It sounds like an interesting program.
Well, you got a chance to hear some of what Congressmember Kucinich had to say. Can you talk about what you see as the cause of this blackout and what are some of the solutions?
Yeah, well, first, I think it's useful to have a kind of electricity 101. Electricity, like a lot of other network industries, telecommunications, the airplanes themselves, ground transportation, those are all situations where you have two components. You have the stuff that flows around, the electricity, the airplane and passengers, the messages over the telephone system, and the thing it flows over, the grid, the wires, the cables, the airports, the air traffic control system. And it's the interplay between those flows and grid that create either reliable or less reliable service, consumer-friendly or less consumer services. Historically, we've tended either to regulate those grids, the network industries, very heavily, or in some cases, actually, government handles very critical parts of the things, the airports, for example. And that creates a lot of rigidities. Politics hasn't proven a very consumer-friendly way of managing resources. So we began this process of liberalizing the system, freeing up the airlines and freeing up other things, transportation and electricity. But we didn't really think about it very well, and we certainly haven't done a very good job of doing it. We sort of had botched freeing up deregulation, as it's called. We broke up the network into the flow portion, the electricity generation and the distribution system, the transmission lines. So we took a system that's naturally integrated and we fragmented it, and then we basically freed up the generation. We made it a market, and it worked. We've had dramatic expansions in generation capacity in the last decade, but we did nothing at all to the transmission grid, so we had all that new electricity but nowhere to go. It hit that new demand, hit the rigid grid, and the result was congestion, or as we call it in the electricity area, blackouts, and, you know, it was a disaster waiting to happen. We didn't do the job. We didn't free the system up, and that's what happens when you do a half-assed job.
Greg Palast, can you respond your assessment of the blackout, its causes and solutions?
Fred just gave you this third grade power 101. Let's look at the players here. It starts out at Toledo Edison, which, by the way, was the model for the film The China Syndrome, about a company that faked its safety and reliability records, if you don't remember that. Then it moves to their division, MetEd, which was owner of and still owns the Three Mile Island nuclear plant. And then it really accelerates when it hits the Niagara Mohawk system, which I investigated for the state of New York, where they were lying about the costs of the Nine Mile Point nuclear plant. So what you have here is the three stooges of the electricity industry knocking their heads together. Toledo Edison had 1 hour of messing around with the down power. Niagara Mohawk has lost 800 jobs to deregulation. Almost its entire maintenance and service staff. That utility has been sucked dry by British owners, so that when that power surge came out of the Ohio region, they couldn't handle it, and they just spread the disease of power failure like Typhoid Mary there. And so what you're looking at here, I used to investigate these guys. I investigated Toledo Edison for the governor of Ohio and Pennsylvania system for the utility commission there. And what you have here, in the old good old days, we used to be able to catch these guys. We used to tell them how much exactly to spend on maintenance. We told them exactly how reliable their systems would be, and they were reliable. We had the cheapest, best electric system on this planet until a disease hit us called deregulation. Pushed by Fred Smith's funders, and I think that it would be helpful if Fred would admit that his funders include the guys that just blacked us out. And when you want to talk about the interplay of systems and networks, the big interplay is the interplay between cash for politicians and the deregulation scourge. We used to have a rule set up by Franklin Delano Roosevelt under the Public Utility Holding Company Act, which said that electric companies could not give money to politicians. When that rule was eliminated, so it was the deregulation not only of the pricing of the system and the deregulation of the quality controls and budgeting of the system, but the deregulation of the political giving in the system, which ended up with a complete disaster, blackouts from California to New York, and this is the first of many coming.
Fred Smith, you have the right of response, head of the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
What he is doing is, I mean, look, white hat, black hat analysis is fun, and investigative journalists do it, but really think of what's going on in the first place. Under government-controlled or politically-controlled electricity, rates were incredibly high in some communities, very low in others, and communities were getting screwed around the country because politicians couldn't incentivize the system to produce rates. But let's look what happens when we freed up partially the system, and we only did it partially, as I've said. The grids in America, the various pieces of electrical grids, are fragmented. There's a law called the Public Utility Holding Company Act, which artificially balkanized the electrical system. People are complaining, why don't we have a national electricity superhighway? Well, we don't, because the laws make it illegal for anyone to provide that. America had the same situation in banking, where we had thousands of banks, whereas Canada had 10, because they didn't have laws that artificially restricted the ability of companies to provide services nationwide. We've got to eliminate that law. That's one of the things that might come out of this crisis, the realization that we should put no barriers to companies providing consumer-friendly services. But the other thing is, we've got to recognize that a grid is every bit as important, and linking grids together is important. In a way, we're climbing an energy mountain. We're mountain climbers in a way. And, of course, climbing a mountain can be a risky thing. You've got to be very careful. But you're safer if you can rope in with a partner, and, indeed, if you can rope in with several partners, if the ropes are strong enough to sustain you, and you're signaling back and forth when you're getting into trouble. And the problem with the electrical grids were that, in effect, we have had no incentive for anyone, not the electrical companies, not the politicians, not anyone, to think about how adequate those interconnections are between communities and how we invest in technology to quickly respond if one of our grids gets in trouble. That's what failed. It was a failure of the political system suppressed investments in these. We could have had a 21st century electrical grid. We don't.
Well, let me bring Jack Cazzazza into this conversation. These two lines, major Midwest blackout of 7 states, essential services, water supply, sewage interrupted for up to 4 days. This isn't a news report from last Thursday or Friday. This is the beginning, or a prediction, in the book, Sham Shame, Inside the Electric Power Industry. Jack Cazzazza wrote it several years ago, formerly with the PSE&G of New Jersey, quit that company, dissatisfied with the management and the direction of the whole electric industry in this country. Jack Cazzazza, as you listen to Fred Smith, what is your response? You worked in the industry for more than 30 years.
First, this comment that there is no incentive and there are no checks of adequacy and so on is just plain wrong, Fred. This is being done through the reliability councils. It is being done through NERC. I served for a couple of years on the executive committee of the New York State Reliability Council, where I chaired the task force checking up on whether they were meeting their reliability requirements. There were incentives, there were rules, And then you say, well, why did it happen? Part of the problem comes, and I agree with some of the previous speakers, from the way we deregulated or restructured. Basically, we focused on implementing market forces. Market forces was the name of the game. Competition was good. Everybody, I'm a believer in competition. I play golf and I like to win, and it drives me. But what happened in the electric power industry is that some of the companies, after we balkanized and made all these individual companies, became more interested in their individual profits than the welfare of the grid as a whole. We lost sight of, federal policy completely lost sight of, the need to provide a technically adequate grid. We have had in this country, and we still have, I disagree with Secretary Richardson, who doesn't know what he's talking about, we still have the best grid in the world. The problem is we're trying to use it in ways that are not intended. This is being a product of the people in Washington and in some of the states who are passing regulations without analysis. A good friend of mine was Joe Swidler, former chairman of the Federal Power Commission. He wrote quite a number of articles. He died recently. About why are we going forward doing these things without analysis? We continue to do that at the present time. In fact, I see statements from Secretary Abrams. We've got to spend $50 billion, get that right, for new transmission. Why do we have to spend this? Because we're trying to do a lot of new and different things with the transmission system, which cost a lot of money and do not predict any benefits to the public. The general conclusion that has been reached worldwide is that deregulation is not lowering prices. It lowers prices in some areas, but increases costs in another. If we go ahead with this transmission reinforcement, that's $50 billion more to charge against the deregulation, most of which we would not need if we didn't do this. The problem is the failure by government to coordinate our, let's call it, our institutional requirements or institutional procedures for that technology. I'm an engineer, and I can tell you there are dozens of engineers out here who are very angry with what has happened and the failure of our government to listen to us. Generally, our federal government is technically incompetent and still is. That's unfortunate that we don't get better people to work for the federal government. The motivation is defend yourself politically, and that's the way it goes. That's one comment I'd like to make. One other comment Fred Smith made is that we've done generation and it's worked. Like heck it is, Fred. The generation costs have gone up massively. We used to charge $30 and $40 a megawatt hour for generation. At times, it's gotten to $2,000. Why is this? Because in some cases, they are paying for generation on what is called a market clearing price, not the actual bid price. In other words, I can bid for generation $100. If the highest accepted bid is $1,000, I get $1,000. There's no other market that's this way. They're doing it with electricity. So we have a lot of problems. I think the key is the failure to coordinate the institutional, economic, and other procedures with our technical requirements of the system.
Now, we have to break for 60 seconds, and we'll be back with Jack Cazzazza,
okay,
author of Shame, Inside the Electric Power Industry, the CEO of CEI, Competitive Enterprise Institute, Fred Smith. Also on the line with us, Greg Palast, who wrote the book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, but before he became an investigative reporter for BBC, wrote a major book on regulation and utilities for the United Nations. We'll also be joined by Harvey Wasserman, author of The Last Energy War. Stay with us. that was the sound of the blackout drummers at Union Square on Thursday night as thousands of people gathered in the dark. Some had candles, others had flashlights, but mainly musical instruments and their feet, drummers and clarinetists and saxophonists and others, spending time together. One of the things that happened during the blackout, a lot of community was built all over the region when people were forced away from their computer screens and out of their air-conditioned apartments. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our discussion in the aftermath of the biggest blackout in U.S. history. On Friday on Democracy Now!, as we were broadcasting by candlelight, we made one of our first calls to Iraq, where people had experienced this kind of blackout, have been for quite a while now. We also can't forget that in Liberia, people have been experiencing this for more than 10 years, as well as in many other parts of the world. But now, talking about what can be done in this country. On the line with us, Jack Cassazzo, worked in the industry for 30 years, then left, sickened by the direction he saw the industry going. He's written the book. It's actually a fictionalized account, so we wouldn't be sued. Sham, Shame, Inside the Electric Power Industry. Greg Pallast with us, who has long investigated the utility industry. And Harvey Wasserman, author of The Last Energy War, The Battle Over Utility Deregulation. As you listen to this discussion, Harvey Wasserman, also you being based in Ohio, where now investigators are saying that the blackout began with First Energy. Can you comment on the discussion you've heard and also focus on the issue of alternative energy?
Well, it's no accident that the same people who have the hole in the head nuclear plant near Toledo are the ones who may have caused this. First Energy owns and operates the Ohio legislature. They're an incredibly corrupt company. They want to bring back online right now this nuclear plant near Port Clinton, Ohio, near Toledo, which is a danger to us all. I mean, thank God it wasn't the nuclear plant that went instead of the grid. These people really need to be re-regulated at very least. We're seeing the failure, catastrophic failure of deregulation here, just as we've seen it in California. And by the way, very quickly, it's very apropos that the spokesman for Arnold Schwarzenegger is Pete Wilson, the very man who engineered the catastrophic deregulation of electricity in California. I think they should be the media should be grilling Pete Wilson and not trying to get to Arnold Schwarzenegger. But the reality is that deregulation is a catastrophic failure in electricity and in other areas, and it's going to leave us completely vulnerable as we go ahead. And what's missing, of course, among so many other things, but really for the future, is the role of renewables. These people, these deregulated utilities are extremely hostile to renewables. Since deregulation has come in, there's the progress towards more self-sufficiency with solar energy and other forms of sustainable electricity has ground to a halt. And the reality is that we need renewables in every building in the country, in the world, really. Every one of the buildings that blacked out in this last situation could have had photovoltaic cells, which translate sunlight directly into electricity, on the rooftops. We could have been using geothermal energy to draw heat and cooling from the sun. Biomass conversion in every building with a generator. You know, all hospitals, or most hospitals, have cogeneration in their basement where they use natural gas to generate heating and cooling and electricity so that they don't go down in blackouts. This is not exactly rocket science. We've had photovoltaic cells since 1957 when they went up in the space in the first satellites. So the reality is that these breakthroughs are being suppressed. In California last year, the city of San Francisco passed a bond issue and used some of that money to put photovoltaic cells on the roof of the Moscone Center in downtown San Francisco. So if this blackout had occurred in the Bay Area instead of the East, the lights would have stayed on in the Moscone Center just as they should have stayed on in thousands and thousands of buildings throughout the Northeast. And the main reason that we don't have these breakthroughs, the technology is there, but the deregulated utility companies do not want these photovoltaic cells and other breakthroughs on the buildings because it cuts into their business and allows people to turn their own buildings into energy generators, which is what we have to have. The grid is an outdated, obsolete concept. It's very 20th century. century. This is a rickety old Rube Goldberg device. No matter how good it is, it's never going to be good enough. Every cent that goes into the grid is a wasted piece of money that should go to make every building its own generator, and that's the future.
Greg Palast, where does oil fit into this, and why isn't the Bush administration, how are they dealing with the issue of alternative energy?
Well, for two things. To some extent, oil has nothing to do with it, but I hear the Bush administration is already beating the drums. If we don't kill a bunch of caribou and start drilling in the Arctic, if we'd only been drilling in the Arctic, we would have had the lights on. Even some of the Democrats, like our chubby Democratic governor of New Mexico, Mr. Richardson, who was Clinton's energy secretary, said, oh, this proves that we need to drill more. It's absolutely amazing. Oil, the lack of oil, or actually the surfeit of oil that we have right now, has nothing to do with the system being blacked out. This is a disease which is of deregulation. So the problem here is not the lack of oil, it's the excess of greed. We deregulated four things. The price, we deregulated the accounting systems, we deregulated the service conditions, and finally we deregulated political giving. Now, the other problem is we used to require utilities to put aside so much of their money for alternative energy, and it was a growing sum of money. And this goes way beyond just it saving oil, so we're not dependent on oil imports or destroying our economy or destroying our environment for drilling. It also gave us a second method of providing electricity, so we wouldn't be dependent on MetEd and the other stooges of the electricity industry. So alternative energy is not just saving oil. It is, we're now learning, and at Harvey Wasserman had dead on. It is one way to keep the lights on. That ain't going to happen under a deregulated system, because there is no way for these big power companies like First Energy to cash in on your photovoltaic cell, on your solar hot water heater. We're not talking about replacing the system and ripping out the wires. We're talking about an alternative, which is a matter of safety and reliability. And these companies, these big new giants, which have been created out of deregulation, this massive new set of monopolies which have been created out of deregulation, they can't figure out how to make any money off alternative energy, so they're killing it in the cradle.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. It's only the beginning of this discussion. Greg Palast, author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Also, I want to thank Harvey Wasserman, author of The Last Energy War, The Battle Over Utility Deregulation, speaking to us from Ohio. And Jack Casaza, Sham Shame, Inside the Electric Power Industry. Jack, I know you wanted to make one last comment.
Yes, I did, very much so. I think we lack in this country what is called a national power survey. One was ordered by President Johnson after the 1965 blackout and so on, which takes a look at what are our options for providing our generation capacity, our power capacity in the future, and then based on these various options, different scenarios, you can argue for photovoltaics, you can argue for nuclear, what kind of a transmission grid do we need? We need to determine what we need before we take all of these steps to implement something that could be that drastically wrong. That is the major problem I have with U.S. government policy. We move forward with doing things without knowing what's right. I think the National Power Survey is vitally needed, Amy, and I think that there's nobody, while I disagree about much of what has been said, I don't think anyone would disagree with making that kind of analysis of the future, 10 to 20 years. Where will our power sources be? What kind of power sources? What will the energy supply be? And determining what kind of transmission system we live. One speaker, Harvey, says we don't need one. Somebody else says we're going to need a superhighway. So let's analyze and find out, not assume. Thank you, Amy.
Jack Casaza, Sham Shame, Inside the Electric Power Industry. Finally, Harvey Wasserman, one last question. We started off with Dennis Kucinich. He didn't talk as much about his early history with the utility industry, but in fact, it's what really brought him a national name and originally took him down as mayor of Cleveland. It was the power of the utilities. You're from Ohio as well, and certainly have followed this history.
Well,
First Energy is the inheritor of Cleveland Electric Illuminating, which beat up Dennis Kucinich and blackmailed the city of Cleveland to take away the municipal light system. We have a municipal light system in the city of Cleveland that dates back to 1914. It works great. It's clean. It's much more accessible to the public, and it offers rates that are cheaper. Public-owned power in the 100 years of the utility business has always been cheaper, always been cleaner, always been more reliable, and this blackout was caused by a utility company that irresponsibly operates two nuclear plants and that is a threat to the safety of the public. And they're trying right now to open up a new a nuclear plant that was knocked out because it, boric acid ate a 6-inch hole through the reactor pressure vessel. And that now that we've seen how they can perform by knocking out a grid and blacking out 50 million people, we have to pray and organize that they're not allowed to reopen the Davis-Bessey nuclear plant near Toledo. That decision is coming up soon, and let's hope that this is a sign to the public to get the backbone to keep this nuclear plant from opening up and instead getting us towards renewables, towards solar, towards photovoltaic cells, wind power, and all the other things that are the 21st century road to electric self-sufficiency.
I guess the question is, those who are promoting alternative energy, what strategy will they use right now to get it out into the public eye? Certainly there is an opening right now. Public interest and attention is at an all-time high.
We have to make it clear that that renewable energy would have made this blackout never happen.
Well, on that note, Harvey Wasserman, I want to thank you for being with us, and that does it for the show. If folks want to get a video or audio copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org. If you miss Friday's show because of the blackout, wherever you were, you can watch it online. You can also sign up for our Daily Digest. Democracy Now! Is produced by a remarkable team of people, Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Lenina Nadal, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Pervez Sharma, Chris Abrams. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer with help from Rich Kim. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.